Well, I'm very pleased to be here with you today, and especially because the sermon today is the first in a series of addresses, as there's a new series going on, Jesus Among the Skeptics, and today Jesus versus the world. And this series will run for a while, and it's going to be a great series to follow everywhere, every week. Jesus Among the Skeptics. I was driving in the car this week, and one of the ABC journalists was talking with somebody else, coincidentally, about China and what's going on in China today. And the guest said something, and the ABC person said, "Oh, I'm very skeptical about that." And then as she went on to talk, it was clear that when she said she was skeptical, what she meant was she didn't believe it. I'm very skeptical about that, she said. And then as it was clear, she was talking about something that she just didn't really believe was true. So as we think about Jesus among the skeptics, this passage today is kind of a way of an introduction to what's going to follow in the weeks to come as Jesus encounters people who are skeptical of him in a whole range of different ways. And one of the things that's important to remember as we look at this passage today, you know, we're often told about real estate. What's the first thing that you must keep in mind with real estate? Location, location, location. Isn't that right? Position, position, position. It's true with the Bible as well. When you're reading the Bible, John 7, what do you keep in mind? Location, location, location. What is happened before John 7, and what's going to happen after John 7, 1 to 13. So it always, when you're reading the Bible, it always fits in a context. So you could really say context, context, context. But in this context, what's just happened before this reading is Jesus has outlined to his disciples what's going to happen in the future, and a lot of his disciples say, "No, we don't buy that." And they walk away, John 6. They depart. And so we come to John 7, and the question is, will people be skeptical of Jesus, or will there be people who have faith? I read a book years ago by a man called Frank Turek, and he wrote a book called I Don't Have Enough Faith to Be an Atheist. It's an interesting title. I Don't Have Enough Faith to Be an Atheist. And Frank says, people say to me, there is no truth. And he says, so I ask, is that true? People say to me, there's no absolute truth. And so I ask, is that absolutely true? People say to me, we can't know anything. So I ask, how do you know? And people say, you can't prove Jesus exists. And so I ask, can you prove that? You know, it's one of those things, we could go on for ages in that kind of theme, but a fundamental reason that we meet today is because we do believe there is truth. And we do believe that Jesus is real and alive. There are some fundamental truths that we are going to hold on to. And one of the things that we see in John 7 is that truth can be held on to because truth is truth whether we believe it or not. Whether we accept it or not, truth doesn't require us to believe it to be true. Truth is, full stop. And so we have to keep that in mind as we look at this passage today. Because one of the truths about being a skeptic is that skeptics, when it comes to Jesus and the gospel and the Bible, it's not a matter of whether you have faith or no faith. Because everybody has faith. Everybody believes something. You can't believe nothing. It's impossible to believe nothing because believing nothing is a belief that you have. Frank Turek says again, anyone who claims to be a skeptic of one set of beliefs believes some other set of beliefs. It's just really a matter of choosing what you are going to believe. John's Gospel wants to make it crystal clear as we begin today that in the end, the most important thing to consider in life is what we think about Jesus. And he's going to outline in this passage at least three types of skepticism that we ought to at least be aware of, lest we have it, but also be aware of it in others. So firstly, I've said in the outline in the bulletin, familiarity breeds contempt, verses 1 to 8. After this, after what? After disciples left Jesus and said, we don't want to have anything to do with this, we didn't realise what we were getting into, some of them, not all of them. After this, Jesus went around in Galilee and he didn't want to go up to Judea because the leaders there wanted to kill him. And his brothers say, leave Galilee and go to Judea so that your disciples there may see the works you do. No one who wants to become a public figure does it in secret. Since you're doing these things, show yourself. Get a publicist. Get social media. Get on Twitter, you know. Go large. Tell everybody what you're doing. For even his own brothers did not believe in him. Well, we know that that's true. We know firstly that Jesus had brothers and sisters. We're told that in Scripture. In Mark 6, the crowd say about Jesus, isn't this the carpenter, the son of Mary and brother of James and Joseph and Judas and Simon, and aren't his sisters here with us as well? So Mary and Joseph had children, and they included apparently James and Joseph and Judas and Simon and some girls as well. So Jesus had a family behind him, and in actual fact we're told they were a long way behind. They weren't close to him. And we told a little bit later on in Mark, in Mark's gospel at least, that at one stage in Jesus' ministry, his family came to have what they call in modern times an intervention. They're knocking on the door while he's in the house speaking, and someone opens the door and says, yeah, what do you want? And they say, we've come to get Jesus and put him in a straitjacket and take him home because we think he's mad. We think he's lost his mind. They came to actually take him away because they were really worried about his mental health. He was making some big claims and they didn't believe them. Not saying Mary didn't, but his brothers and maybe his sisters thought he was mad. So their brothers now say to Jesus, if you want to be the Messiah, well, you need to get up to Jerusalem and show your wares up there. Go large, be big, do the big thing that you're doing. Do all these miracles up there. And they're not saying that because they have a concern that his ministry is being underappreciated. They're saying it because they actually don't think it's real. They think he's either mad or at least wrong about who he is. So they say, go up to Jerusalem, go large. And so Jesus is amongst skeptics, even when he goes home for Passover dinner. You know, he's in a family who think he's either mad or crazy or something. So his first skeptics are the ones who are closest to home. It's not necessarily too far from the mark that for many of you, in your Christian life, you've had family who think you're mad for being Christians. I never personally experienced that in my upbringing, but I know that certainly in Hong Kong, many people who came to put their trust in Jesus, the most sceptical people were the people who knew them best at home and watched them closely to see if any change took place. But the Bible makes it clear what the nature of scepticism is here. The first truth about scepticism that I think is in this passage is believing one thing means you can't believe something else. If you're going to have a set of beliefs, then if you're going to believe in Jesus, you've got to put the other set of beliefs out of your life and put them away. So for his brothers and sisters who knew him closely, they couldn't find any fault in him, but they weren't prepared to put the beliefs that he's just our brother. I mean, he's our half-brother and we don't really believe in him. They kind of allowed, I think they were too close. Familiarity bred contempt of who Jesus was. They weren't prepared to open their minds and think about what he was saying and put aside that he was in the family. And so therefore, their minds weren't open to the possibility, let alone the reality of who Jesus really was. And Jesus had said on other occasions, you're either for me or against me. There's no half and half. In the brothers' case, they were ultimately against him. Now, later we see that at least some of them, we don't know, maybe all of them, but some of them were actually became disciples. Certainly James and the book of James, brother of Jesus, and the leading elder in the church in Jerusalem later on. And many people think that Jude, the book of Jude, is also written by Jude, the brother of Jesus, another brother. But in any case, there were disciples of Jesus who came to understand who he was. But even at the time when Jesus was hanging on the cross, he entrusted the care of his mother into the hands of a disciple, because there was no brother or half-brother in his family that he felt he could, who was a believer, who he could entrust the care of his mother into. They became to faith afterwards. Familiarity breeds contempt. And often when it comes to skepticism today, skepticism will often be found in people who have, in some degree, been exposed. Maybe they've been to a church school, or maybe they grew up in church and then left it at a certain time. They are people who, someone once said, have become inoculated against the gospel of Jesus. And so they become skeptical because they've had a little taste, but they've not really taken Jesus into their life seriously. The second point is, so blind they can't see. After he'd spoken with his brothers, verse 9, he stayed in Galilee. However, after his brothers had left to go up to the festival, he went also, not publicly, but in secret. And now at the festival, the Jewish leaders were watching for Jesus and asking, where is he? So now we look at the Jewish leaders. They're skeptical, with capital letters, skeptical. The Jewish leaders were looking, verse 1, for a way to kill him. They'd made up their mind about Jesus. And John makes it clear that the timing of this event of Jesus going up to Jerusalem is the Jewish festival of the booths or tabernacles, and we had that first reading. And there were three big festivals in the Jewish calendar: Passover, Pentecost, and the Feast of Tabernacles or Booths. And we heard the reading which gives the historic antecedents for the Booths or Tabernacles Feast, celebrating the Exodus, God's provision of sustenance and direction in the wilderness. And there were two big themes for the Feast of the Tabernacles. Now, we've just recently, in October, in the Chinese calendar, celebrated Mid-Autumn Festival. And the Mid-Autumn Festival is particularly celebrated in a particular way with, someone help me, with lanterns, the Lantern Festival. When we lived in Hong Kong, we'd take our children to the Lantern Festival nearby at night with all the lanterns lit up. It's a festival of, if nothing else, lights, beautiful lights and lanterns. It's great for the children, and we lived opposite Kowloon Park, and all the lanterns would be lit up, and we just enjoy. It's a festival of light. Well, for us, Christmas is kind of a festival of light, isn't it? There's the Christmas tree with all its lights on, and there could well be a big tree. Certainly in the city of Sydney, there'll be a big tree lit up with lights, and maybe you'll have a carol service. And we used to have a carol service in our church, and we were banned from having candles in the church, like hundreds, everyone holding a candle. So we, like in China, you can get anything. We sourced from China electronic candles, and so everybody had their electronic candle to wave, and we turned the lights out and sing carols. It's a festival of light. Well, one of the elements of the Booths festival was light. And in fact, in the temple, a big candelabra would be set up, and families would come with their children to see the beautiful lights at night. And the other element of the Festival of Booths was water. And part of the official ceremony on the day, they'd go to the Pool of Siloam in Jerusalem and get a big pitcher of water, and it would be poured out as a ritual thing to pour out the water. And if you put the light and the water together and combined it together, there was one element that the Feast of Tabernacles was known for above all else. And we have a visual aid here. Feast of the Booths was the joy festival. It was the happiest, most joyous festival of the year. Now, I've told you all that for a reason. The Feast of Tabernacles is coming up. The people are streaming in. The Jewish leaders are there. And what are they focused on? Jesus, God, the light of the world. God, living water. Are they focused with joy? What does John say they're doing? They're looking for Jesus to kill him. They're looking for Jesus to kill him. I've retired now and I'm not any more a senior minister in a church. And my wife's not here today, Janelle, but one of the things she says she really enjoys about having me sit next to her in church on Sundays is that I'm no longer looking around, making sure the Bible readers are here and the prayer is turned up. And is someone looking after the children and is that okay? And has everybody got a seat? And, you know, I was always alert. I was like a bird, always looking around, you know, making sure. She says, Janelle says, now you just sit there, look ahead. And I think it's not my gig anymore. I don't have to worry. You know, I can just relax. See, the Jewish leaders, when Jesus comes up to Jerusalem, their heart is not in the festival, praising God with joy. They're not thinking about the elements that remind them how God led them through the wilderness, provided them with a pillar of fire by night and a pillar of cloud by day to direct them and lead them forward. And he provided water when they were thirsty and almost dying. And all of this is because one day he's leading them forward, because one day the Messiah will come and the Messiah will actually be the fulfillment of all their heart's desires and promises. The Feast of Tabernacles had so much meaning in it. And what are these leaders doing? They're looking out for Jesus because they want to kill him. They are seriously not got their mind on what they should have. Their skepticism is that they're so blind, they just can't see that Jesus is telling them that he's the living water, that he's the light of the world, and that the Messiah has come. And when the Messiah comes to Jerusalem, they want to kill him. On the very day they should have most had their mind on the joy that God gives them, they're looking to kill him. Their skepticism is because their mind is just closed and they have blinds over their eyes. They can't see at all. The first truth about skepticism is that believing one thing means you can't believe something else. You've got to choose what you're going to believe. The second truth is no amount of evidence can make people believe. They've got to choose to evaluate the evidence and make a decision. And these people had their minds closed. Many, many people in society today are skeptics of the Christian faith. Why? Not because they've examined the evidence, but because their mind is closed. I was at a dinner party once and I was sitting next to a youngish woman, by my age anyway, younger. She was in her 30s. And we're having a lovely chat over dinner. And I said something about, she said, you're a minister, aren't you? And I said, yeah. She said, yeah, I'm an atheist. I get that a lot. You know, oh, you're a Christian. Oh, I'm an atheist. And I feel like saying, well, thank you for telling me what you believe. I wasn't trying to convince you of anything, you know. I'm an atheist. And I don't know where it came from, but just in my brain, I said, oh, gracious, you're so young to be an atheist. And she said, what do you mean? I said, well, an atheist is someone who says they know there is no God. So I said, so you've obviously spent years of reading and investigating the Bible and Islam and Buddhism and Hinduism. You've done a lot of work. I'm in awe. that you've come to the decision after extensive investigation, there is no God. I said, if I were you, I reckon it'd be safer to say you're an agnostic, because agnostics just say they don't know. I mean, but atheists say, we know. I've checked it all out. She said, yeah, I think I'm an agnostic. She said. And we became good friends after that, because I thought that was a bit more honest to say than have, I know there's no God. You know, well, skepticism, which just says, I just refuse to believe, is a form of skepticism which Jesus meets, and we meet it today as well. And then there's kind of a third type of skepticism, damned by faint praise. In verse 12 and 13, among the crowds there was widespread whispering. Some said, he's a good man. Others said, no, he deceives the people. But no one would say anything publicly about him for fear of the leaders. And we looked at two groups of skeptics, Jesus' brothers, his family, and the Jewish leaders. And both have their own reasons for not believing who Jesus is. They've got their own reasons. There's the ordinary people. What do they think? Some people think that Jesus is good. And I don't quite know what to do with that. I think they may mean he's a good man. I think they're probably generally warm towards him. But they're still damning him with faint praise, don't you think? Just to call Jesus a good man is kind of, it's not quite what Jesus had in mind. Jesus is a good man. Well, he's more than that. But I don't know that I want to be critical of these people. I think that what John is saying is that the crowd was divided. Those say he's a good man, those who say he's a bad man. They're all correct in their own way. But some people seem to have decided in favour of Jesus. The other group are sceptical because they think he's leading people astray. And have they considered what he said and did? Have they looked more closely? No, they probably haven't. The thing that stops any further discussion, though, is a general fear about what the leaders will say. There's kind of like a social pressure, a political pressure, to not talk about it too much. Boy, does that not describe Australia, don't you think? If you're a Christian, there's kind of like this pressure not to want to share it openly because people will be critical. Political correctness, that you don't really want to talk about things too much. I think that kind of scepticism where it's sophisticated not to believe or have any faith, and it's just stupid to have any faith at all, is a political correctness that just kills honest conversation. It's easy to be sceptical. Oh, I'm sophisticated 21st century. I believe in science and I'm sceptical about people who believe. It's kind of really cool to be like that. It kills honest inquiry. And it ultimately, scepticism becomes self-defeating. So let's conclude. Verse 8, Jesus says, the world can't hate you, to his brothers, but it hates me because I testify that the works of this world are evil. There are three different types of skepticism which we see in the passage. But Jesus is saying, if people really get what I'm about, then they'll hate me. Not just be skeptical, hate. Peter Fitzsimons, I don't know whether anybody reads the Herald at all, the red bandana one. Do you know him at all? He wears a red bandana, and I forget who he's married to, someone important. Yes. And I don't normally in my sermons isolate people out, but he is so public and he's made so many statements that I kind of feel I can mention his name, and I'm sure he won't be offended. But the red bandana one says, he was on the radio recently talking about the Republic because he's chairman of the Republican movement. And a woman who is a Christian, I think she was phoned in, and she said that she's not too fussed about the questions about the Republic because she believes that Jesus is the king of Australia. She believes that Jesus is the king of the world. And so therefore she's put her trust in the one who's truly king of Australia. And Peter Fitzsimons said, I am flabbergasted. He said, I am totally flabbergasted that anybody could be so stupid as to say something like that. He was And at the end, when the ABC person wound it up, we want to thank people and want to thank you, Peter Simon. He said, I'm still flabbergasted that anybody could say that. His skepticism was so visceral that he was offended by someone saying that Jesus is King of Australia. Offended. Like he wanted to kill her almost, you know. But if Jesus is saying, if Peter Fitzsimmons really understands what I'm about, he will want to kill me. Because what Jesus is saying is that if you're opposed to God, you're an enemy of God. And you're opposed to Jesus, you're an enemy of Jesus. Verse 6, my time is not yet here. For you, any time was good enough. The world can't hate you, but it hates me. My time has not yet come. It's a theme in John's Gospel, and eventually Jesus' time does come. And what is his time? The time when the hatred of the world is so great that he is crucified and he dies and he faces Satan, sin and death and the full wrath of God, and he conquers Satan, sin and death, and God raises him up. That's the time Jesus is talking about. The mother of all battles is about to happen. Today in Australia in 2018, Jesus' time has come. We have seen the impact of that and we put our trust in him. And so therefore we ask the question, what do we do with skepticism? Jesus among the skeptics. Those who have got their own familiarity with Christian faith will be contemptuous of it because they've never put their trust truly in Jesus. Those who are skeptical of Jesus, because to actually believe in Jesus means that they're going to lose all sorts of things in their life that they think are really important. To put your faith in Jesus, you've got to stop believing other stuff. And ultimately, the crowds who just can't make their mind up and it's too much trouble maybe to even decide. We think he's misleading people and we don't want to know any more than that. I put a quote in there in the conclusion. In the race of life, always back self-interest. At least you know it's trying. You heard that quote? Some of you might recognise Paul Keating having said that many years ago. He was quoting Jack Lang, a former Prime Minister, Labour, many years ago. In the race of life, always back the horse called self-interest, because you know self-interest is always trying. It's a joke, really. But when it comes to scepticism, ultimately, scepticism is driven by self-interest. What is good for me? I won't believe in Jesus because his claims are not good for me. I'll have to give this up and that up. I'll have to admit I'm wrong. I'll have to actually follow a different set of beliefs. Believing one thing means you can't believe something else. You've got to make a choice about what you believe in. No amount of evidence can compel anyone to believe. No amount of evidence. And the red bandana one is just representative of a lot of people. He calls God the cosmic Jewish zombie. He calls God a sky fairy. Very academically rigorous thought about God. He's considered carefully and come to that conclusion. I don't think he has. Skepticism can become self-defeating. It may well be you know people who are skeptical about the faith that you hold. It may be that you have some skepticism yourself and some level of doubt is worth exploring. But ultimately, we have to understand that if we're going to put our trust in Jesus, we have to make a decision. And in the context, when some disciples left Jesus, Jesus says in John 6 to those disciples who stay, what about you? Are you going to go? And they say, well, where are we going to go? You alone have the words of eternal life. I hope that as you follow this series, you'll allow that you can learn something from the skepticism of the world, not be afraid of it, recognize that if you stand for Christ, there will be people who are skeptical of you, but our faith is a reasonable faith. we put our trust in the Lord Jesus Christ, and I have for many years taken comfort from being able to say, when people say they don't believe, I will say to them, that's because you don't believe Jesus rose from the dead. Because as far as I'm concerned, the resurrection of Jesus is the showstopper. If you can believe Jesus rose again from the dead, then everything else will fall into place. If you can't believe that, then you won't believe anything at all. Frank Turek, in a video that I watched, a woman stands up and says, I don't believe in the resurrection because in the history of humankind, no one has ever risen from the dead after 3 days. It is highly improbable that anybody could. And Frank said, that's the very point. That's the whole point of it. It's impossible, except God did it. He raised up his son Jesus. And so I hope that we'll have confidence in the resurrection, confidence in Jesus, not be troubled or threatened when people say they are skeptical, but say, well, my faith is a reasonable faith in a person, Jesus. Let me tell you about him and what he means to me in my life. And allow the fact that skepticism is ultimately the product of a closed mind. And only by God's grace and mercy can he open that mind, and by our love and gentleness, we may perhaps be used by him for someone to actually see that Jesus is the light, that Jesus is the living water, and people themselves might actually experience the joy of knowing Jesus as their Saviour and Lord. Amen.